If I figure out where you live and I know approximately how much your family makes and how many kids that you have and what investments that you're holding, suddenly as an attacker, I know how much to ask for ransom. And these cases are not unheard of.
Welcome to the Insurance Innovators Unscripted, the show dedicated to innovation in the insurance industry. Each episode, you'll get a dose of thought leadership from the industry's top business minds, influencers, innovators, and executive leaders. If you want to transform your corner of the industry and exchange innovative ideas, you need to subscribe to this podcast. Now here's your host, Abel Travis.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Insurance Innovators Unscripted podcast, dedicated to insurance innovation. So there's been a lot of talk and emails about the 100th episode, and I want to thank the listeners out there for sending across all of your thoughts around what we should do for that episode. So I am going to be partnering with Accord and hosting a live podcast in front of a live studio audience during Accord Connect. And that is going to be the 100th episode, and we'll be talking live with some of the insurance innovators in panel form just in regards to what they're seeing in the industry and what those organizations are doing in relation to insurance innovation. So once again, I want to say thank you for to everyone that had a lot of ideas around what that episode should look like. And we will absolutely do some episodes based on your ideas for other episodes in between now and after that 100th. But, you know, it's going to be really exciting. That's going to drop sometime around the 29th and 30th of October. I'm hopeful that you're going to continue to get a lot out of the podcast discussion that you'll hear between now, during that live session, and then going forward. But, you know, you all have been such a great audience, and it's just been growing so significantly in regards to, you know, the listenership of this podcast. But I've been hearing more and more about a lot of people that are taking what they've learned from the podcast and applying it to what you do on a day-to-day basis. You know, so I do really want to say thank you for all that you do. So I'm excited to be speaking with Elias Pyrounin. Now, he is the president of Tractus Event Passport, an organization that works with financial services companies like insurance organizations and other types of financial services or companies with conferences and internal trade shows. So Elias, it is a great pleasure to have you here on the podcast. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Abel. This is going to be awesome.
Yeah. So, hey, you know, I want to let the audience know what we're going to be talking about today. And it is really about the importance of cybersecurity within the insurance space and just in any other space, frankly. But, you know, even before we get into today's topic, would you mind talking a little bit about your background and also the connection to the industry as well as this topic of cybersecurity?
For sure. So when I was 4 years old, I got my hands on my first computer, a Commodore 64, and I really never left the IT industry ever since then. And really since then, I've just been working with computers basically as long as I can remember. I did a computer science degree up at University of Waterloo, started my own company, did a lot of subcontracting and contracting work with Fortune 500s and government institutions, and a lot of small mom and pop agencies. I've done a lot of work with small insurance advisors, so people that are running their own firm or maybe have a couple people in their office. Through Tractus, we work with large insurance companies to help run their conferences. And as a side benefit of that, I get to sit in on a lot of professional development days and learn a lot about the industry by proxy. My deepest connection to the industry was a long time ago. I actually worked as a claims processor, manually typing in insurance claims into an ancient computer system. Which gave me a lot of insight as to how the industry runs. So I've been keeping, and where the cybersecurity side comes in, I've been keeping a close eye on cybersecurity really since the early days. When I was growing up, it was the early days of the internet. Like, you could open up Network Neighborhood, if you remember that, on Windows 95, and see all the other computers in your neighborhood. You know, this was a time before firewalls or we had any idea what computer security even was.
And I definitely do remember the time of Network Neighborhood, which was really, at least from my perspective, on the earlier days of when the internet was becoming, something major. Now, as we jump into today's topic around cybersecurity and the insurance and the financial services space, I'm gonna entitle this one something that you've given some talks on recently, and that's Beyond Password. And for the folks that are listening, when you think about password, it's spelled with some letters and some numbers, but it's leveraging people using that as their primary security tool for access to the different sites and things that they need to get access to. So, Elias, let's jump right into the topic. Now, you've done a lot of education in the space of cybersecurity. So when we think about our industry and insurance and others, why, in your perspective, is it really an important thing for the industry to understand?
I think it's important for the industry to understand because let me give you a bit of a story. When I was doing research for my keynote, Beyond Passwords, I discovered a really chilling fact, and that is you can go on to certain dark web websites and go and buy somebody's complete identity for between $100 and $400. And then I thought about that and went, wow, imagine if you're a professional and your laptop gets stolen, or you suffer a break-in and somebody makes off with your computer or your phone. As insurance professionals, I mean, I've bought life insurance, I've bought critical illness, and I know how much information I had to hand over to get that insurance policy written. And I remember thinking to myself, wow, if a bad guy got their hands on that data, they would basically have my identity, right? Because think about what kind of data you as a professional are going to collect about your clients. First name, last name, address, probably some banking details so that you can set up the direct withdrawals, right? You might have to get social insurance number or social security number if you're in the United States. But as an insurance professional, you're going to collect a lot of data about your clients, and you're not just collecting data about that one particular client, you're probably collecting data about a lot of them. So if you think about your book of business, if you've got a couple dozen or a couple hundred potential prospects, between prospects and customers and clients, you probably have information on a lot of people, and just think about what that would be worth to an attacker, to a criminal, that if they were to go and take your book of business and sell those identities on the dark web, how much they could make from it. And it's really scary when you think about how that data could be used.
There are tons of pieces of data that's out there that organizations collect on their customers, but also when you think about it even broader than just the customer data, there's employee data, there's business trade secrets, and so on. Now hackers are absolutely interested in those data points of customers from organizations like insurance companies and other financial services organizations and healthcare organizations. Now, that's a lot of data to collect that can be leveraged to drive revenue for those hackers. Why, in your opinion, though, is this data as valuable to the hackers and just in general? Why do you think it's so valuable to the hacking community to have this data from the business community and from customers?
From them, it gives them more options to sell that data off to third parties for nefarious purposes, or worse, commit some sort of identity fraud. So, attackers are the name of the game for them is to get as much data as possible and then use it as quickly before somebody catches on that it's stolen. Going even more nefarious than that, it's possible if you have enough data on somebody. So if you know where they live, what their family makeup is like, what career they have, if you do a bit of matching, The one story I give in the keynote is if I figure out where you live and I know approximately how much your family makes and how many kids that you have and what investments that you're holding, because if I get an insurance professional's data, I might know that. You know, for example, I might know what life insurance or what investments you have. Well, in the worst case scenario, if we're dealing with a high wealth individual, a high net wealth individual, suddenly as an attacker, I know how much to ask for ransom. And these cases are not unheard of. That's the scariest part, is this data is being leveraged in that way. So, I mean, because you really have to think about, there's kind of the common criminal that's just looking to make a quick buck. And then there's the dedicated, organized crime syndicates that are looking to use that data for nefarious purposes, especially against, say, a high net wealth individual.
Yeah, there is, and I can see why, right? Because there's tons of value, and probably the value that a high net worth individual is providing and producing could be something that can be used, to your point, nefariously in a way that's going to help whoever it is that's looking to access that information, either, you know, do a ransomware attack or an attack in a way that makes it look like it's that high net worth individual. You know, a lot of what we've been seeing recently comes down to organizations, and these seem to be, you know, really well organized crime rings that are sending information and emails that looks as if it's coming from a high net worth individual or from an executive, and it's not really coming from that individual, but the person that's receiving that can't really tell the difference. So it might lead to, you know, things like, you know, sending off funding or sending off a check or a wire transfer or something like that, because the request came in from an individual that looked like it was who it came from. So, you know, with that said, you know, personally, even this was within the past month or so, there was an organization that I use in which my personal information was hacked. And it's a well-known daily deals organization. I'm not going to say the name here, but what that organization was hacked and my personal information was taken and it was used to order things like electronic gift cards and those things, which could be redeemed immediately. Now, I still haven't been refunded by that company, you know, based on the hacking that occurred. But I just wonder, you know, how can we protect ourselves as an industry and just frankly as a consumer when there are large companies that are out there that's not really doing what's necessary to protect their own customers?
Well, one of the biggest protections you can give yourself is to make sure you've got a really trusted, established IT professional at your disposal. You know, as a professional, you've probably got a lawyer for handling your company's legal affairs. You probably have an accountant so that when you file your tax return, you feel like you're actually being open and honest with the government and that you're doing it right. And you probably have a team of other professionals for your other utilities, like you've got an electrician to deal with your electrical needs at your building. You've got a plumber to deal with your plumbing needs. What I've found in my experience is that IT, so your internet, your email, your website, your data protection, that's really been seen in the past as a reactive service, that you deal with it only when there's a problem, and the most you do is to get your computers and your phones set up to the point where you're just minimally functional. Things work. You know, I can get access to my email, I can get access to my bank account, and my clients can now email me. That's good enough. But then the problem is that can leave you open to a lot of threats if you don't have things set up correctly in the first place. And there's a lot to consider when you're actually setting up those IT services. A lot of times, the biggest one I go to is email. Because a lot of times we get an email address and think, okay, cool, we're in business, we're ready to go. Well, it depends on who you're getting the email through. Like, is your email being provided by your internet service provider, like as a nice optional extra because you're their customer? Or is your email being provided by a free provider like Hotmail or Gmail? Or is it being provided by a company whose sole business is email? You know, where's that email being stored physically in the world? Like, there's a lot to actually think about that doesn't get considered, and a lot of this can be prevented by making sure that you have a trusted IT professional that you can call, kind of like you have a trusted lawyer that you can call to help you navigate this world.
Yeah. And you're right, especially as you start to think about the email situation and where it is, where it's housed. You know, I know there are tons of regulation out there, depending on the country that you're in, that has regulation in regards to how the data that's used within on those servers, if it can leave the country, if it has to stay in the country. But that data is governed by the regulation of the country. So we, let's say here domestically, either in Canada or the United States, you know, could be governed by a completely separate set of rules and regulations in the event that the servers of that organization might sit in a country like England or France or even Russia, you know, for that matter. You know, so as we look at that and all of the different regulatory and requirements, depending on the country that you're in, you know, how can companies make sure that they're fully in compliance with those regulations, just knowing that it's completely going to be different depending on the country that you're in, and then there's the potential to have clients and customers across a multitude of countries throughout the globe.
The first step is to ask questions like, where is my email being physically hosted? Like, can you, as a service provider, can you, as an email service provider, can you guarantee that my email is going to stay within this country, like the actual email being stored is going to stay within the country that I say and will be subject to my country's data privacy laws? And I'll tell you right now, the most common answer from a lot of these free providers is, and that's a really bad answer. And expanding on your point, it's one of the reasons why that's important is to figure out what country your data is being stored in, is that you might, like, the United States has different privacy laws to Canada, which has different privacy laws to the United Kingdom, which has different privacy laws to another country like Russia. So all these privacy laws are different, and they get even more different still when you consider that if I'm a Canadian and I'm using an American company to host my email, well, suddenly this is email service that's being provided for a foreign national. So my privacy rights are going to be completely different than if I was using a Canadian company to host my email. And same with an American having their email hosted in Canada, for instance. You know, you're an American entity using a Canadian service, you can basically assume that you don't have all that much privacy to begin with. So asking those questions about where is my data actually going to be physically stored is a really important one. Knowing who has the legal access to read that, to read your emails as well, is very important. It's why I recommend that advisors and agents and really anybody running a professional practice, if you're dealing with confidential client data, I get nervous if when they use a free service like Gmail or Hotmail or now it's you can get free Outlook.com accounts. Because in those privacy policies, those companies, if it's a free service, that has to be paid for somehow, and usually that's through advertising. And a lot of those services will scan through your emails to figure out what advertisements to target you with. So that means that at some point, some algorithm has access, the legal access, to read that through that email. And being a computer science person, I also know that every now and then, humans need to get involved to take a look at what the algorithms are coming up with and review them and tweak them, which means that at some point, your confidential information, if you're using a free service, might be read by somebody.
And you're right. You know, the free services probably don't provide the same level, and I'd say probably they don't provide the same level of confidentiality and limitation in how the data is being used in relation to those services that are paid, like those that leverage Outlook or the Microsoft paid platform. Now, you know, with that said, I wonder, you know, as we look at how companies dole out information to their employees, you know, a lot of companies give employees access to laptops that they might take in a hotel. And of course, as those laptops are connected to the wireless access system of the hotel, that creates some exposing of potential data breaches, you know, to the data, as well as provide them with things like credit cards and a whole bunch of other things. Now there's something that you do to really hit home as to why organizations need to think about putting these protections in place for their customers and for their employees. You know, so you'll use your phone, you know, when you're giving a speech to scan the room and potentially someone's leaving something private on the table, like a purse or something, to show them that, hey, you see that I now have access to your credit card information just through doing a simple scan. Now, someone in the hacking community could do that and leverage that information for nefarious purposes. So, you know, first and foremost, you know, tell us a little bit more about that, and what individuals can do to protect themselves against things like that. Because in the event, by protecting themselves, they're also protecting the integrity of the organizations that they're working with. So talk to me a little bit about that in general.
Sure. So I've got three party tricks that I do now. The first one I call, which you alluded to, I call it, is this your card? And I will use my smartphone with an app that I've vetted. And what I'll do is basically just run it close to somebody's purse or wallet that they've left on the table. And up on my screen will pop their credit card number with the expiration date. And I'll turn around to them at some point and say, hey, is this your card? And inevitably, their face will turn white and they'll go, how did you do that? And I'll show them how I did it. Just a simple scan of the credit card. I need to get my phone within a couple centimeters or about an inch for the attack to work. But when you think about maybe a crowded situation like at an airport or at a networking function, you know, the chances of getting to close proximity are a lot higher. But it strikes it gets to the heart of one of the biggest threats that any professional will face, or really anybody will face when it comes to security, is the physical security of your devices. So I'm talking about the physical security of your laptops, iPhone, iPads, tablets, whatever you've got. And I outline this in the talk. It's something called the evil maid attack. And how that works is usually some sort of a compromised agent will come into the hotel room. They'll be, you know, generally they'll have a legitimate role like housekeeping, but they've actually been hired by some third party, sometimes a state, sometimes organized crime. And what they'll do is they will attempt to access your laptop or attempt to access your smartphone that you've left in the hotel room. And to give you an idea of how fast you can actually have your data compromised, I recently dug up an old phone of mine. This is an Android phone from sometime in 2010. Within 5 minutes, I had it hooked up to my computer and I had all the passwords downloaded off of it. So generally when you leave your hotel room, you're going to be out for longer than 5 minutes at a time. And it's not unusual to come back and see housekeeping in your room and think, oh, well, maybe I'll just give them another 10, 15 minutes and I'll come back. That's more than enough time to compromise your passwords. There's another attack that I've actually had to do for legitimate purposes. I had a client once that they could not remember the password to their Macintosh. It was an elderly person. They just could not remember the password of their Macintosh. And I was able to get into the Mac, boot it up into a special mode, get into the Mac, copy the encrypted version of the password, and just brute force guess it on my computer, and I had their password within about 6 seconds. So, I mean, that's how fast these attacks can happen. And it's all down to the physical security. If your device is not with you and I as an attacker can somehow get access to it, even for a couple of minutes, then all bets are off.
The biggest problem is, and I know a lot of organizations don't have this necessary security in place, is things like password length, you know, for example, where, you know, it takes a short amount of time to the point that you made to actually hack and understand, you know, exactly what that access point is going to be and how long it would take to access that particular device in its own. And that depends on the length and the size of how big and how complex that password is. You know, so there's always better things that organizations can do in order to limit themselves from a breach or from exposure. But you're also right in another sense, because even when I go to you know, conferences and when I'm going to you know, travel for business, I oftentimes tend to leave my laptop in a hotel room, and in all honesty, you never know who could be coming in or out of that hotel room, just giving access to staff and others that could potentially, you know, get access in a nefarious way. Are there things that organizations can do that's tangible to help to limit others from getting access to that information?
Absolutely. One of the services that we use at my company, and I've had a lot of clients use this for their own company for not just their email hosting, but for managing their computers, is using Microsoft Office 365. And that, what we found is that comes with a lot of features like, for example, two-factor authentication. We're all log in with a username and password, and then I will have to authenticate that login by hitting accept. I'll get a message on my phone saying, hey, there's a login attempt. Is this you and do you want to approve it? And I have to hit accept before I can even go any further. So in that case, that's, for me, that's upping the bar that a criminal or an attacker needs to break in order to get access to my data. Other ways is Windows these days, the professional versions and the enterprise versions have a lot of built-in encryption. So you can actually do full disk encryption and require a password on startup so that even if an attacker rips the hard drive out and puts it in their computer, they still need to get access to that, to your decrypt password. Now, that being said, if you encrypt your whole hard drive, but then you write down the password on a sticky note and put it on the bottom of your laptop or your tablet, that security is not going to do you a whole lot of good. One of the simplest ways to prevent a lot of these intrusions, though, is to use long passwords that are easy to remember but hard for somebody to guess. It turns out that having a short password that's filled with letters, numbers, special characters is actually not that secure. You can go to Best Buy today, buy a $500 computer, and crack every single 8-character password in 6 seconds. It doesn't matter what the password is. You can try them all in 6 seconds, and that's on a $500 computer. But if you have, say, a 12-character password, even if it's all lowercase, and even if it's, you know, just words, you're still looking at least about 120 days to execute that same attack on that computer. It's going to take a lot longer for an attacker to break a long password. And then if you throw in a special character once or twice in there, you're upping your protection factor that much more. So the easiest, simplest way is to use a really long password that is easy for you to remember but hard for others to guess. Set different passwords everywhere. This is something that I've seen a lot of people, you know, everybody kind of nods their head and says, yeah, I should do that. But to drive that point home about using a different password, think about it this way. If I get your email password and I have your bank and I have your bank card, and I know that most people use the same password everywhere, suddenly I have access to not just your email, but your bank account. And if I've got access to both, even if those messages come in saying, hey, here's a weird login, is this really you? You know, I could potentially change your email password, lock you out of your email account, and then just start trying to do password resets on all sorts of different services that you use. So again, using different passwords everywhere is absolutely critical. Using a service like Microsoft Office 365, where you can have that two-factor authentication, where you can actually set up password policies that enforce a password of certain length. With 365, we use it actually internally as our logins to our computers. So our email address and password becomes our login to our computer, and then we can enforce other policies like Windows Hello, where we have to enter a PIN on top of the username or password, or do facial recognition, so adding more layers on that an attacker would have to break. So it's educating yourself about what services are available. And again, this is why I say have a trusted IT person with you, or at least that you can call, that can help take you through these kinds of things and say, here's what we need to do to mitigate your risks. If you're working for a larger organization that provides a lot of hosted IT services for you, you know, read through their security policies, ask a lot of questions, and see what they're doing to keep your data secure. Chances are they've thought a lot about security and they've put a lot of money and effort into keeping your data secure. The last thing you want to do is thwart those efforts.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and just given one of the things that you mentioned, you know, there's a story of mine that I ran through recently. And it was around, you know, my banking password continuously getting me having to continuously update my banking password. And I was wondering what the heck was going on. But, you know, so when I called the bank, they said, hey, someone's been looking to try to access your account. And, you know, after a couple of times, it winds up not allowing them. So you basically you have to change the password. Well, the way that the authentication was also set up was done in a way in which when that happens, the bank sends a text message notification to my phone. And that notification is supposed to say, hey, is this you? And so on and so forth, and validate that you're looking to access or that you lost your password. Well, come to find out, I never received any of those notifications, but it was because not only was someone trying to access my banking details, but my phone SIM card had actually been cloned. So all of the text messages were going to whoever had this information from my SIM card or from my phone. But luckily enough, you know, the bank that I used caught that and didn't enable that particular change. Now, that was one of the financial institutions that I worked with. Another one, unfortunately, did wind up getting compromised. But of course, I was the situation was taken care of. Now, you know, that leads me to think a couple of things, right? And now I'm pretty sure that there are areas in which I might have used the information that could have, you know, exposed, you know, myself as a target or so. But even recently, you know, just over the past couple of weeks, you're starting to see this thing on social media, which changes the age of someone and basically shows that, you know, what you would look like 30 years or 40 years down the line if you upload a picture into this application. Now, the tool is a new one that's been developed and hosted by a foreign organization. Now, in that instance, you know, from your perspective, where do you think the data lies? Because, you know, as a part of the terms for that application, the company had perpetual access and use of the images and the data that was used within their systems. So I wonder, you know, what are your thoughts there and who really has ownership of that data, just given the way that it's being used?
Yeah, the Face App controversy, I guess we want to call it. It's a real fascinating one. I've read stories that say that this is that it's hosted by a Russian company. I know that their CEO has made some statements that they don't keep most photos, which implies that they are keeping some photos. It's a real fascinating scenario, and one where I think people are starting to take a look at privacy policies a little bit closer. I mean, that said, when you look at the privacy policy for FaceApp and then read the privacy policy for, say, Twitter or Facebook or any number of these social media services, you have to ask yourself, these are free services. What am I trading to actually get access to them? So that means that they're going to do something with the data that you provide them and monetize that somehow. So I look at a company like FaceApp and what they're doing. You know, they're going to use these images. I mean, they're providing a service in a way that they're showing you, here's what you look like when you age, and it's actually quite convincing. But it's a little bit scary too, because I look at that and think, wow, this is a really interesting way to get a huge collection of high quality facial images and create deep fakes very quickly. So I'm a little concerned about what's actually happening with the with those selfies that are getting transmitted, and I'd be really interested to know whose selfies they've kept, because the statement that their CEO gave implied that they're deleting most of the pictures, but that they're keeping a select few. And I don't want to put on a conspiracy hat or sound like I've gone off the deep end, but when I hear that they're getting rid of most of them but keeping some, I can't help but think, what's their selection criteria? What makes them keep a photo? And I mean, just because they say that they're going to be more transparent, I mean, they're a foreign entity with, and if they are Russian based, I mean, they're a foreign entity that's based in Russia, and their foreign national privacy laws, you know, just are not up to scratch. I think that's the most diplomatic way to say that. So I would be very concerned about any time you've got an app where, you know, it says one thing and it's going to be this facial recognition and show you what you look like when you age. Because my mind also goes back to the Cambridge Analytica hack. It wasn't a hack. It was people willingly handing over information on Facebook unwittingly over to Cambridge Analytica. And I mean, there was a period of time before 2016 where, and I'm sure if you were on Facebook for more than 5 minutes, you saw these little polls like, you know, what Disney character are you? What's your personality type? What's this? What's that? But when you read the policy and realize what information that these little apps were asking you for, and in return for what you got, you know, they were asking for complete friend lists, email addresses, the works. And that could be a potential huge breach of privacy to a company that you don't know, that might not even be based in your country. So who knows what's happening with that data?
Yeah. Absolutely. And you're right. You know, number one, no one knows what's happening with that information, but it also could turn out to be information that could create a bigger picture of the individual and potentially be very compromising to either that individual or a particular organization. Now, you know, I even go through something, and you've talked about that in the about this thing that I'm about to bring up in the past, but it's the FISA Act, or the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, what that allows organizations like the CIA, the FBI, and others to get access to electronic records like email, or records that organizations like Facebook or other social media companies might have on you in terms of the data. So I wonder, from your perspective, is there a way for consumers and companies and, you know, just organizations in general to limit access through things like the FISA? Or do we not have much, if any, control over any of that?
It depends on the service that you're using. If you're an American citizen and you're working with American companies, you're going to be subject to American privacy laws as an American citizen. And generally, those are a lot stronger than if you were dealing with privacy rights as an American citizen dealing with, say, a UK-based company or a Russian-based company or Canadian-based company. So your best bet is to kind of buy local whenever you can. That's going to give you the best set of privacy rights. The other recommendation I would have there, again, when I look at the easiest example is email. You look at, who am I hosting my email with, and am I paying for this service? Because that's also going to dictate, if you're paying for your email service, then chances are it's going to be professionally hosted. There's going to be a lot of checks and balances as to who can legally access that data. And chances are that the company themselves will put policies in place that basically say, unless we get a court order, we don't take a look at anything. That would be my biggest recommendation. The other recommendation I would have, going back to physical security for a second, and this is one that I see with people that travel nationally and internationally, is say you're heading on vacation, you're a professional, you're going on vacation, and you're leaving the country. Think about what data you're bringing with you. Because when you get to a border, so say you're entering the European economic area thanks to the Schengen Agreement, when you're entering another country, when you're at the border, you pretty much don't have any privacy rights. Those border agents are looking for anything that would be remotely suspicious so that they can deny you entry. They want to only let in anyone who is not considered a security threat. And so they have pretty broad powers when it comes to inspecting your devices. And especially if you're going to a country that may not have the best civil liberties records. There are countries that can simply arbitrarily detain you at the border. And I mean, those are extreme cases. But, there are countries where you could travel. And, if the border security wants to take a look at your phone or tablet or laptop, they're well within their rights to ask you to hand it over. And if you refuse to hand over the password, can simply detain that laptop or detain that device until such time that they can get into it. And again, if that device is out of your hands, then any bets about the security of that data, all bets are off. And you kind of have to hope that they're not going to do anything, illegal or wrong with that data of yours. So what I would recommend on the physical security side is if you're traveling, think about that data as extra baggage that you're bringing with you. Should you bring your primary phone? Or should you, say, throw it in a safety deposit box at the bank and travel with a burner phone? Should you travel with your laptop, especially if it's the only computer at your place of business? I know a lot of advisors and professionals that only have a laptop or only have an iPad these days. And if they lose it, that's their business. And if that device gets detained for whatever reason at the border, and even assuming in the best case scenario that that device gets detained at the border and, the agents are 100% cooperative and they follow the rules to the letter, that's not even thinking about the scenario where somebody accidentally drops that device and that's the end of it.
Yeah, I, Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, so, hey, you know, Elias, you know, one of the questions that I always ask, right? And I always want to make sure that our conversations are tangible, especially given the types of topics that we hear. You know, so if someone is listening to you and I speak, and if they want to make sure that they could apply what we've talked about to their own organizations, what's the one thing that you want to make sure they walk away with?
I think I'll give you two things that I'd like them to walk away with. The first one being the action they can take while they're listening to this podcast is, if you've got a short password, go change it. And I'm talking, and by short, I mean if it's less than 12 characters, go change your password right now. Because anything less than that is just not secure these days. You can break a length 12 password with a $500 computer in about a quarter of a year. So, and if you've got somebody that's really dedicated, they can break it even faster than that. And like I said, an 8-character password, 8-letter password, I can break them all in 6 seconds. So go change your password. The second is to really think, to have a sit down and think about your risk profile when it comes to your business. You if you're an insurance advisor, you're probably, when as part of your sales process, you're probably sitting down with your clients and saying, tell me a little bit about your life. Do you participate in sports? Do you travel a lot? You know, do you have any pre-existing health conditions? You're asking those questions to get a profile of that person to figure out what products they qualify for and what products would best protect them and their interests. You need to think about and ask those questions about your own IT security as well. Who's got access to client files in the office? You know, and just start there. You know, never mind the digital services. Start with, at your office, who's got access to your files? You know, figure that out. Figure out who's got access to what. You know, if you're in an office where you might not be using a professional email service like Microsoft Office 365 or Google's G Suite for Business, you know, and you're sharing access through, and I've seen this. I've seen companies that will set up a Google Calendar and they'll share the same username and password with everybody in the office. It's like, who has access to that? And you want to figure that out so that you know what your risk profile is right now. Where are our vulnerabilities today? And once you start to figure out the physical side, then the services will begin to sort themselves out too. You'll be able to actually sit down and say, okay, where is my email being hosted? Are we relying on this? Are we relying on our internet service provider for this service? You know, or is this service being hosted by a free provider? But I would say the biggest tangible action you can take today is figure out who has access to what, and then figure out who has physical access and where are you actually storing physically your devices when you're not with them. Are they secured? Are they stored securely? You know, start from there.
Absolutely. Well, hey, Elias, you know, I do want to say thank you. You know, this was a great conversation around the subject topic. You know, if anyone wants to learn more or just to get in contact with you to continue the discussion, you know, what's the best way for them to do that?
Best way these days is Twitter's way too noisy. Facebook, I don't like. I've been hanging out a lot on LinkedIn these days. So if you want to look me up on LinkedIn, I think you can put a link in the show notes. The other way is head over to the website www.northernhci.ca. That's NORTHERNHCI.ca. That's the parent company that owns all my good stuff. Or send me an email. We can probably list that in the show notes, or just honestly, the easiest way these days is to get a hold of me on LinkedIn. I'm pretty much there every single day posting something. So
perfect.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, hey, you know, once again, I want to say thank you. This was a great conversation, and I look forward to getting connected again in the future. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Insurance Innovators Unscripted Podcast. Now, as always, if this is your first time listening, hit that subscribe button so you can hear the new episodes every time it's released. So tune in to hear more about concepts in insurance innovation or things that's going to help your policyholders, like the conversation that I had today with Elias. So once again, thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week.